in Abu Akleh. Abu Akleh was killed after being shot in the head while covering Israeli army raids in the northern occupied West Bank last week. Palestinian journalists, academics, and senior Palestinian officials attended the ceremony. Palestinian officials accused Israeli regime forces of deliberately killing Shireen Abu Akleh.
Shireen was killed in cold blood, like many Palestinian journalists. Israeli forces have killed some 50 Palestinian journalists during the last 22 years. We demand that Israeli leaders be held accountable for their crimes against Palestinian journalists.
Abu Akleh was wearing a press vest that identified her as a member of the press when she was shot by Israeli snipers. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, protective gear that clearly indicates individuals are journalists should grant them extra protection, not make them targets.
We demand, and I think the international community should all demand justice for Shireen Abu Akleh. What is happening from the Israeli occupation, the constant targeting of journalists, is just a systematic, ongoing, punitive reaction that keeps on going. It has been going on for so long, and it still is continuing.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye. Under the Geneva Conventions, journalists, like other civilians, enjoy protection amid armed conflicts.
I believe that, you know, killing Shireen Abu Akleh was not the first crime that the Israeli occupation has committed, and it won't be the last one. I believe that as long as there is a military occupation of the Palestinian territories, these crimes won't stop, especially against Palestinian journalists.
While covering Israeli attacks, Palestinian journalists work hard to avoid being part of the story themselves.
Observers say that Shireen Abu Akleh's killing is another example of the Israeli regime's brutality against the Palestinian people. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A witness to the humanitarian consequences of U.S. sanctions on Iran. Alina Duhan is the U.N. Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of the unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. On her 10-day trip to Iran, she paid a visit to 30 ministries and institutions to assess how the U.S. sanctions have affected different sectors in Iran. She described the sanctions on Iran as devastating and inhumane.
Economic challenges arising from unilateral sanctions and lack of international cooperation based on shared responsibility prevent the government of Iran from providing sustainable assistance to the most vulnerable categories of population.
In her exclusive interview to Press TV, the UN rapporteur spoke about her observations in Iran, saying the Iranian people are bearing the brunt of U.S. sanctions.
The darkest part of all that is the fact that all population of the country, regardless of the nationality, is affected by the use of sanctions, even the nationals of countries which impose sanctions. And Iranians abroad are affected. And I believe it's even worse that imposition of these comprehensive sanctions delivers the feeling of fear.
To many Iranian patients, sanctions are an unending nightmare, barring them from accessing life-saving medicine. Hundreds of thalassemia patients and people with EB, among others, are grappling with drug shortage in Iran. Many of them have died because of this problem.
Well, the United States argues that its sanctions do not target Iran's health sector directly. But the sanctions on its banking system have made it complicated for the country to purchase medical items. Does this amount to an escape route for the U.S. to shrug off its responsibility over the existing problem in Iran's health sector?
I see here two problems. So point number one, that when it comes to the banking sector, there are no proofs that they are illegal. Basically, they are illegal. There are no grounds to impose these sanctions, and it's already a problem by itself. And the humanitarian impact of banking sector sanctions has been illustrated in the report and will be illustrated in more details. When it comes to the health sector, naturally there is a general license issued by OFAC entitling for humanitarian exceptions in the health area. However, in reality, it's nearly not possible. It's not possible because of the number of issues. The very first one to deliver humanitarian goods, you still need to get OFAC license in many of the cases. And getting OFAC license is very lengthy. You need to consult lawyers or people who used to deal with OFAC license. Responses come within several years.
Alina Duhan started her mandate as a UN rapporteur in March 2020. Ever since, she has paid similar visits to four other countries, including Zimbabwe and Venezuela. UN rapporteurs are appointed by the UN as freelancers and are not affiliated to and paid by the UN. That's why Ms. Duhan promised that her report will not be influenced by politics.
Ms. Duhan cited countless instances of the humanitarian side effects of U.S. sanctions on Iran, dismissing the move as a tool to achieve political gains. Tehran now views Ms. Duhan as an independent and internationally endorsed witness to the issue, urging her to report it as it is to the U.N. Human Rights Council. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Palestine Embassy in Rome has placed in its premises a condolence book for people to express their grief and condemn the brutal killing of Palestinian veteran journalist Shirin Abu Akla. Shirin was covering the Israeli troops' raid in Jenin for Al Jazeera last Wednesday when she was shot in the head by Israeli forces. Her tragic death and the beating of Palestinian mourners during Shirin's funeral sent shockwaves across the region.
I know Shirin personally. My reaction was crying for hours. We felt really sorry, deeply inside. We felt sorry because we feel that we are alone. Where is the international community? Why they are staying silent for suffering of 14 million Palestinians?
On Tuesday, a number of Italian lawmakers went to visit the Palestinian ambassador to Rome to sign the condolence book for Shirin. The delegation of parliamentarians sat with the Palestinian diplomat to discuss how to get the Italian government involved in urging the international community to break its silence in regards with Israeli crimes.
We will file a parliamentary motion in which we demand the government to commit to set up an international investigation committee on what happened in Jenin and during the journalist's funeral.
The United Nations and the European Union, among others, have called for a full investigation into Shirin's assassination, described by many as a deliberate killing in cold blood. Problems have once again emerged in reporting the truth regarding the Israel-Palestine conflict. That comes as most mainstream media have provided a biased portrayal of the assassination of Shirin Abu Akla, omitting Israel's responsibility and considering as facts only the statement issued by the Israeli Defense Forces.
Unfortunately, it is a total double standard when it comes to Italian newspapers reporting on the Israel-Palestine conflict. When there are clashes in that region, journalists say Palestinians die, while Israelis are killed.
Thousands of Palestinians residing in Italy have commemorated the Nakba through a number of small and large initiatives. They say the assassination of Shirin is one of the many ways Tel Aviv seeks to silence those that expose the apartheid regime. Max Civili, Rome.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to another edition of Spotlight. In this edition, the BRICS countries have backed a Chinese suggestion that the bloc should be expanded. A joint statement by the foreign ministers of the bloc, which also includes Brazil, Russia, India, and South Africa, following an online meeting on Thursday, supported its first expansion in a decade. However, no candidate countries have been named so far. In this edition of Spotlight, we will be discussing the possible expansion of BRICS and what that means on a global scale. To discuss that further, we have with us the Washington Bureau Chief Executive Intelligence Review, William Jones, and also author and journalist Arnold August. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's begin with our guest, William Jones. Why do you think BRICS's expansion is being proposed at this point in time?
Well, look, what you have in the world now is the United States is out to bring the countries of the world together in a policy of degrading Russia, essentially decoupling Russia from the world community, in effect. They have succeeded in bringing their European counterparts on board, although not without opposition. And now, of course, President Biden is in Japan working on the Asia-Pacific side of this. This campaign is, first of all, directed against Russia, but also against China. The United States administration, the Biden administration today, has the policy that they must be the rule givers of the world. It is a policy of great hubris. And of course, hubris is also sometimes a very dangerous quality. Most of the world is opposed to this policy, including, I believe, even within the countries that have gone along with it. I think they're going to see a lot of opposition. China knows that it is also a target of this policy, has extensive relations with many, many countries, and has been a strong proponent of economic development over the last 10, 20 years, actually the strongest proponent. The BRICS cooperation has been a part of bringing together countries, particularly in the developing sector, to call for more multilateralism, to assure that other countries other than the great powers, so-called, have a say in the direction of the world. And at this point in time, of course, there is a question. Where is the world going? Will it go to this one world dictatorship of the United States, or will other countries become involved and raise their voices? The other countries are not organized in the same way as NATO and the U.S. alliances, and therefore I think this is a step in the direction of increasing the number of groups that are working together to defend the issue of multilateralism.
Okay, so Mr. August, we just heard Mr. Jones pointing to some geostrategic developments, including the war in Ukraine and the U.S.-led NATO expansion and all that. Do you think that that has anything to do with a BRICS decision to expand and enroll more countries? What is your point of view on that?
Definitely, I agree. In fact, one has to take into account that this is the first BRICS meeting since the February 24th Russian special military operation in Ukraine. It's very significant, I guess a bit ironic, because in my view, one of the reasons that the NATO pushed Russia to the brink was to try and weaken Russia. As a result, what they don't like is the increasing collaboration between Russia and China. So here we've come full circle since then, today, in May, when China has bounced back in order to propose the enlargement of BRICS. And if I recall correctly, the five members of BRICS, three of them abstained when the United Nations General Assembly voted on the American-backed resolution to impose sanctions against Russia. So three out of five abstained. So right there you have another ripple effect of what happened since February 2000, this past year. And once again, I think it's poetic justice that China is at the center, along with their allies on an equal basis, such as the other members of BRICS, to strive to expand the already burgeoning, already developing multipolar world against U.S. hegemony. It had very important effects. For example, even in Latin America, there is a big controversy going on now with regards to the U.S. so-called Summit of the Americas in June 2022, in which they are excluding countries such as Cuba, Venezuela, etc. So you have a situation now where perhaps will Argentina be asked to become one of the additional members of BRICS, which is quite possible, because Argentina visited China at a crucial time when the U.S. Narrative against Russia was taking place. And what if Argentina is asked to join BRICS? It would be great. And then how will this affect the upcoming summit that's going to take place in Los Angeles, if it takes place, because so many countries have refused to bow down to the U.S. dictate that they are excluding Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua. So this is only the beginning. I think it will have very important effects, not only in Latin America, obviously in Europe, and also in the rest of Asia.
Okay, so Mr. Jones, as Mr. August also pointed out, we have Argentina standing in line. Earlier this year, Argentina had expressed its desire to join the bloc, and analysts say Indonesia is also a likely candidate. How could these two countries contribute to the bloc? Or would this change BRICS?
Well, no, I think it would strengthen BRICS, as a matter of fact. BRICS has, of course, its economic cooperation, but it's also they make statements on the international situation, which are extremely important. And in spite of the diversity of countries, they can always find a commonality with regard to the direction that the world should go. That is, commonalities in terms of supporting statements, for instance, as in the BRICS statement today, calling for peace negotiations on the Ukraine-Russia border, which, of course, the United States is opposed to and is does not want to see happen anytime soon until Russia is degraded. So that it has an important political role, but it also an important economic role. And this is one of the organizations. Look, the developing countries over the last 50 years have done a lot of things to try and bring together their united force in order to bring forward a global development policy. This has never really succeeded. We go back to the Bandung Conference, which was probably the initial attempt at this, and it hasn't succeeded. It hasn't succeeded because they haven't been able to create the kind of a force that can counter the power of the Western economies in determining the fate of the world. And therefore, this will bring together whatever choices are made in the short term. And I do see that an expansion of BRICS will not be limited only to one or two countries, but potentially it can be even greater, because this is one of the main organizations that has been consistently pushing for global development policy. And of course, you know that you notice that President Xi addressed the BRICS meeting, and he underlined two major important points. One is the need for this global security initiative. That is, that the world must be based on the idea that the security of one nation cannot be done at the expense of another nation. Of course, this is what is central to this whole Russia-Ukraine crisis. And the second thing was that he insisted that they work together collaboratively on the issue of development. And of course, China's put forward this global development initiative, which, if realized, would begin to repeat the successes that China has had in their own country in terms of poverty alleviation. So these are things in which the BRICS countries, as they're constituted today, in addition of any other developing sector countries, would only strengthen the momentum towards development and towards peace. So I think this is a very important step that they're taking.
Okay, so Mr. August, you seem to be agreeing with our other guests here. So I would like to know what you think about how the expansion of BRICS can change the political landscape.
Okay, well, the previous speaker already mentioned that point, but I would like to expand on one point. In addition to the obvious economic factors of integration and cooperation, there are very important political factors. Just reading from the Chinese report, according to it, Xi Jinping said that these five countries should coordinate closely on major international and regional issues, take care of each other's core interests and concerns, and respect each other's sovereignty, security, and development interests. And went on to say, the President Xi went on to say, to oppose hegemonism and power politics. And this is important in my view. He went on to say, resist Cold War thinking and block confrontation. So it's economic, but it, I think it's a very important step in terms of the resisting the Cold War that is sweeping the world as a result of the US-NATO domination. And this is sort of a challenge to that mainstream narrative that people should, of the world, country, especially in the global south, should stand up to this whole very dangerous narrative that is going on, and instead take a common position, even if they have different political system, which they obviously did. For example, Brazil at this time on one hand, and China on the other, India, of course, very different political and economic system, but China is playing an important role to try to weld these different countries with different system towards an increasingly stronger opposition to U.S. hegemony and in favor of a multipolar world.
Well, exactly, and of course, we also have to point out that this announcement comes at a time that the BRICS New Development Bank, the NDP, has opened its Indian regional office. So, Mr. Jones, how can financial cooperation between the member states affect Western hegemony?
Well, it's obviously the initiation of the Belt and Road Initiative was a game changer in development policy. For the first time in decades, there was a major shift, major push to try and institute development based on interconnectivity, based on building railroads, bringing the world together. This has always been central. The United States developed like this, Russia developed like this. Railroads and connectivity is essential to creating the basis of infrastructure in which economic development can occur. Now, what also happened at that time is that new institutions like the AIIB and the BRICS New Development Bank were set up specifically to finance infrastructure development. The old development banks, World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, they had long left the field of infrastructure development because they felt it takes too long financially, there's not quick profits, and a variety of reasons, and a general disinterest in any kind of major program to create economic development in places like Africa and Latin America. And that these new development banks, like the BRICS Development Bank, created a new momentum. They're going to be even more important now because, look, the money that is being spent on this war effort and the sanctions that are being imposed on Russia in particular, but also on China, is going to create a major financial crisis in the world. We're looking at what's happening in food prices now and energy prices. This is going to get much, much worse, making it almost impossible for, without a major reform of the international financial system, for any kind of development policies in these parts of the world. So that's also what the fight is all about, to try and maintain the financial capabilities of pushing economic development. And it's going to take more than simply the existence of these various banks. It's going to require a major reform of the international financial system. And my suspicion is that given the dangerous situation that we're facing with the real possibilities of a nuclear war, I think there's going to be such serious economic consequences that you're going to have a reaction in most of the countries of the world against this war policy. And maybe that would provide the basis for people to take a look and say, pull together a financial system that works for the benefit of the people and not for the profits of the few.
Okay, so considering what Mr. Jones just mentioned, Mr. August, do you think that this kind of financial cooperation can help counter U.S. sanctions?
Well, I think it is actually happening now, especially since February 24th, 2022, where there have been, collaboration with regards to currency going on between, on the one hand, Russia and China and other countries in Asia. So this new BRICS orientation, especially if it allows and is successful in bringing other countries into BRICS, it'll even stimulate further the search for alternative currencies based on the U.S. dollar. For example, I don't have the exact figures, but since the U.S. tried to punish Russia with regards to currency, the ruble, the value of the ruble has increased considerably. So there are very many possibilities that are coming out of this new situation. I'd just like to add one point. When the United Nations General Assembly took place and the U.S. resolution to condemn Russia, China abstained. Some people say, oh, well, why didn't China oppose it? China was right. It abstained in order to maintain its very favorable position internationally as an important power, not imperialist, as some would like to say, but an important progressive anti-imperialist power to try to rally other countries that have different political systems and even perhaps different views on the issue of Russia. So this very wise Chinese decision to abstain in the United Nations is now bearing fruit as we see China is being successful in further developing a whole block against U.S. hegemony, not only with regards to Ukraine, but in general, all of U.S. policy. For example, looking forward to China, we know the United States is also trying to provoke something with regards to Taiwan. So these countries, BRICS, and any new countries that adhere to BRICS will be on the side of China against the attempt that we know is going on by the U.S. to try to provoke something with regards to China by instigating some kind of a rebellion or whatever by Taiwan against the Chinese government.
Okay, so Mr. Jones, do you believe that this could all lead to the weakening of the U.S. dollar?
Well, it already is. And, of course, in terms of the financial cooperation between Russia and China, there are already measures being taken in order to maintain cooperation in terms of the physical economy. Financial arrangements are being made. The RMB is already playing a major role, not as a reserve currency, but as a currency which is becoming dominant in many of the transactions that China has with all the other countries. So in one sense, the United States could be shooting itself in the foot with this $30 billion to Ukraine rather than to New York or to California, because that is causing major inflation. The dollar is going down. The stock market is at least starting to tank, and it's up and down, but it's moving in the direction downward. And this may end the dollar hegemony, which has been really the stronghold of American power, together with military powers, that financial power. And it's American. It's Anglo-American, I must say, because New York isn't the center of international finance. London is and always has been. But they're hand in hand, hand in glove with the United States. That system economically is being threatened with the effects of all this spending and the sanctions, the effect it's having on the dollar. So I think things are already in the works as emergency measures in the financial realm, which could very well serve as the basis or the core of a new international financial system when the dust settles after this crisis.
Okay, so Mr. August, we're running out of time, but this is also a very important question. China has pointed to, quote, factors of instability and insecurity, which are increasing and has suggested that BRICS members should strengthen mutual political trust and security cooperation. Does this mean that we should be looking at an alliance between countries involved in activities far beyond economic cooperation?
I think we have already been a witness to this tendency of increased cooperation of countries, especially in the global south, to oppose U.S. hegemony and oppose what I guess many people in the south see, unlike in Western Europe or in North America, as U.S. provocations, especially against the global south. We recall not too long ago when the United States was pressuring Pakistan to vote with the U.S. against Russia in the United Nations General Assembly, the then president of Pakistan saying, no way, we are not lackeys of the U.S. So this has, you know, very far repercussion. This, that was a setback, what happened in Pakistan, but I'm quite sure this could reverse itself, and Pakistan could go back to the type of government that they had before, what was really a coup against it. So there are a lot of features, countries, interests, that do not want to succumb to all the U.S. provocations that they carry out throughout the world with their 800 military bases, opening up new military bases, doing combined military operations with between the United States and other countries of the West in the South China Sea. So the more countries rally around BRICS and support that overall position against U.S. hegemony, and as you say, very concerning destabilization measures, that so this new BRICS alignment expansion led by China is playing and is going to play a very important role in the international landscape in the coming weeks and months.
Okay, Mr. Arnold August, author and journalist out of Montreal, and William Jones, a Washington bureau chief of the Executive Intelligence Review out of Leesburg. That's all the time that we have for this edition of The Spotlight.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The coming mass migration of flood-prone areas will have huge social and economic costs, but the US government doesn't have an adequate plan. We now present you an article written by Max Ufberg. The piece is titled, It's Happening Now, How Rising Sea Levels Are Causing a US Migration Crisis. Sea levels have risen about 9 inches since 1880, with one-third of that gain from the last 25 years alone. Every year, a flurry of reports are published warning of the risk to towns and cities along the coastal areas of the United States. It's one thing to hear about a looming disaster, it's another to see the cataclysm play out in real time. That's what's happening in Tahola, a village on Washington's coast that acts as the capital for the Quinault Indian Nation, a tribe of about 3,600 members. In Tahola, climate change caused sea level rise has brought to the community a fast receding shoreline, and with it, a heightened threat of flooding. According to Quinault estimates, the ocean level could increase by 2.6 feet by 2100, pushing storm surges higher and bringing waves closer to town. On an overcast February morning, Raleigh Ralston, the 62-year-old treasurer of the Quinault Nation, drove his silver Ford SUV down a network of Tahola's unmarked gravel roads, telling me about what this place used to look like before climate change permanently reconfigured the landscape. Parked on a rock face overlooking the Pacific Ocean, he nodded towards a moss-covered boulder towering out of the water. As a kid in the 1960s, Larry Ralston said, he was able to trek by foot to the rock, and now he reckons the water is 30 feet deep. Back then, the ocean didn't seem like a menace, at least not an existential one. But that's no longer the case. Some 660 Tahola residents who border the ocean now find themselves living in an increasingly dangerous flood zone. The only solution is for everyone and everything in the village to move uphill. Larry Ralston said, "We can see firsthand what's happening. There is no denying it. Tahola signals what's to come for coastal communities across the country." Already about 15 million American homes are at risk of flooding, and the threat is only going to get worse. A report released in February by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, projected that sea level along the U.S. coastline would rise by 10 to 12 inches on average in the next 30 years. An uptick that would make damaging flooding occur 10 times more often than it does today. William Sweet, an oceanographer with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's National Ocean Service and the country's top scientist studying sea level rise, said, "It's important to understand in these communities that sea level rise is happening now. Its impacts are happening now, and those impacts will grow worse in the next 30 years. Mining nuisance flooding will be replaced by flooding that's more damaging to economies and to infrastructure. That future could very well touch off a mass migration of people away from coastline and flood zones. Research published in 2020 in the journal PLOS ONE estimated that sea level rise could cause over 13 million Americans to relocate inland by 2100, an outcome with huge economic, social and political consequences. Yet, even with the deluge of warnings, there is no centralized lifeline available to coastal communities in the United States. There are a number of federal programs designed to give assistance to such areas through government bodies like the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, and the Department of Housing and Urban Development. But those pots of money are far from adequate to tackle a problem of this scale. Some local governments have chosen to offer, and in a few cases mandate, buyouts to homeowners in vulnerable areas, who wind up dispersing. Others would prefer to keep the neighborhood intact, in Tahola's case, by moving the whole village. In 2017, the Quinault Tribal Council adopted the Tahola Village Relocation Master Plan, which would move the lower enclave of the village about a half a mile uphill by 2030, where a new 200-acre development would offer flood-free land for over 300 housing units, a police station, a courthouse, a K-12 school and a museum, among other buildings. The initiative makes the Quinault among the first in the United States, alongside communities in Louisiana and Alaska, among others, to voluntarily opt for a strategy of managed retreat away from impending climate threats. To date, the council has been able to build a new administrative complex, a so-called Generations building, to house Head Start and senior programs, and approximately 150 homes, construction that is owed to a combination of U.S. Department of Agriculture grants, housing and urban development money, and the tribe's own funds. To pay for the rest, Larry Ralston estimates they'll need an additional $200 million, a daunting sum, especially considering the bipartisan infrastructure bill that was signed into law by President Biden last year provided just $130 million to support relocation efforts for the 574 federally recognized tribes across the United States. According to the Department of Health and Human Services, there are roughly 5.7 million American Indians and Alaska Natives in the United States, many of whom are on the front lines of climate change. A multi-year study published last year in the journal Science found that indigenous nations in the United States not only lost 99% of their historical land, but what relatively little they were eventually allotted are often more exposed to climate change hazards than their historical lands. The Quinault Nation settled permanently on their 189,621-acre reservation, much of it conifer forest and unsuitable to farming, in the 19th century, after a long and at times contentious negotiation with the Washington government and the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Though the allotted land was still a far cry from what was lost, the ocean provided a natural icebox for sockeye salmon, known as blueback among the Quinault peoples, a unique fish that is central to the Quinault identity, and is under threat due in part to ocean acidification and warmer waters. Larry Ralston said, as his SUV ambled past a large illustrated cutout of the salmon affixed to a lamppost, "There's a parity between the Quinault people and the blueback. We tried to save our blueback so we can save ourselves. Just 2 weeks later and 2,400 some miles away from Tahola, I was in the Allen Field subdivision of Houston, Texas, talking with Dolores Mendoza, a 35-year-old mother of three. She is trying to figure out how to convince people in the neighborhood, many of whom are relatives, that the country's effort to remove them from their homes shouldn't be ignored. Tahola and Harris County are a study in contrast. The former, a cash-strapped program that, if successful, would keep a neighborhood intact, and the latter, a messy but better-funded effort that will ultimately move people out of high-risk zones but tear a community apart. I met Dolores Mendoza, who works as a credit controller at an inspection agency, on a chilly afternoon at her former home, a three-bedroom house that's just a stone's throw from the Greens Bayou watershed. Harris County bought the place in December, paying Mendoza a total of $300,000 for the property, $70,000 for the house, and $230,000 to relocate. The sale was a coup for her, given that she paid $62,000 to buy the 1,200-square-feet house in 2010. She has since moved to Kingwood, a wealthier neighborhood about 15 miles away. That's not to say that Dolores Mendoza was keen on leaving. She grew up in Allen Field and, by her count, still has family living in 13 different nearby houses. She said, "I wanted this community. It's not pretty to look at, but my family's here. It's only a matter of time before that's no longer the case." As we walked through the beige-coloured house, which had been ransacked and vandalised in the 2 months since its sale, Mendoza recalled how the place used to look when she and her three children lived there. Harris County is a sprawling region of 4.7 million people, about half of whom live in Houston, Texas. Much like Tahola, it is caught in climate change's crosshairs. Hurricanes are becoming more common in the area, bringing with them enough rainwater to flood the state's bayou systems. Hurricane Harvey, which hit Houston in 2017, and took the lives of at least 88 individuals in Texas, was the third 500-year flood within the last 3 years. Worse yet, the Texas coastline has sunk about 2 feet within the last century, due in part to excessive groundwater pumping, making the state more vulnerable to flooding. But Harris County also bears a different distinction. It is the national leader in federally funded home buyouts, responsible for some 2,500 acquisitions, on top of 1,000 homes purchased by the Harris County Flood Control District with local funds. Since the 1980s, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, has supported over 43,000 property buyouts in the United States. That is well short of the 3.63 million people in the country who are likely to encounter flooding every year.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.